This conference will now be recorded.
I'm so glad you could all join us today. My name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci. I'm a longtime patient with multiple digestive motility disorders. At the age of 26, I became very ill, and then it took 5 years for a definitive diagnosis. But within all that time, I was very blessed to be able to work within the organization, the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, which has grown immeasurably as a result of, I'm sure, the internet and people knowing more about these digestive motility disorders. With that, I remember when I was dealing with all this chronic illness, some of the feelings that I had mirrored what my family were going through. So when I was feeling isolated and alone, they too felt isolated and alone. And that's going to be a theme that we'll probably talk about throughout this program. Just a few reminders that when during this program, if you would like to participate, please state your name before you speak and every time you speak, just your first name. That way there we can match the voice with whoever is talking. We ask that you do not give out your contact information during this program, and also that you do not request others. If you're interested in communicating with other people outside this program, you can always reach out to AGMD, and we can see if we can facilitate that for you. We want to be respectful of everybody, so please do not use any profanity during the program. And be mindful if there are a lot of people talking, because there are a lot of people who signed up for this. We want to make sure everyone gets a chance. So it would be a little respectful of other people's times. With me here today, we also have Julie Martinez. And Julie is going to be talking a lot today about loneliness and isolation as a parent. But Julie, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, this is Julie Martinez, and I'm in Southern California and have a daughter with chronic intestinal pseudo obstruction. You want to keep talking?
Yeah, that was a quick introduction.
She was diagnosed properly at the age of 13, but I had been hauling my kid before specialists, top specialists, since she was 2 years old, with bowel impaction that they couldn't really find a reason for, and I stayed stuck in that medical system for many, many years until she was properly diagnosed. So her condition was not properly diagnosed and left completely 100% untreated until she was about 13. So a child that wouldn't go to the bathroom for 2 weeks at a time was just deemed as functional constipation, severe constipation, and thought to have a real strong behavioral component to it, and that she would do this to herself and should somehow, you know, help herself. And so that's how she was treated and approached in the medical system for many years, which led to a lot of grief within our home and a lot of confusion about her condition and what could be done to help her. It wasn't until we bounced around to going on into our third pediatric center. So we live in Southern California, where we're sitting in the middle of three very reputable centers that people come from all over to visit and bring their children to for the experts here. And so we were not at a shortage of doctors that could help. We had many, many at our fingertips. They were difficult to get in front of, but I don't mean to bash at all any doctors or anybody in that world, but I do strongly feel that her condition was approached with a very limited view, and doctors that were just disconnected and disengaged and did not deem her condition as serious. So by the time we got to the third facility at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. We got in front of a gastro doctor who specialized in Crohn's and celiac, a rheumatologist who pointed us in the direction to her, and then in turn led us to a gastromotility, neuromuscular gastromotility specialist, who they are rare. So that last doctor that helped the most was rare. However, if some of the words impaction and motility had been used early on, and if more interest, more dedicated interest had been invested in my daughter's care, I would have sought that kind of a specialist even outside the state if I would have known. So shame on me, shame on them, but we're in a much better place now. But years and years of disconnect within the medical world and really friends or family either. And so that's kind of what we were talking about today, with feeling isolated and feeling that you don't really have any supporters or anybody that understands, even within the medical establishment. So that can be a really tough thing. And I've thought a lot about why that could be, when doctors are there to help, when they're paid to help, and your friends, you know, friends and family love you, and how could you end up feeling alone? So anyway, that's my thoughts. If anyone wants to step in, they can feel free to share their story, or I can keep talking, whatever.
Anybody want to jump in? All right, Julie, let me just interrupt for a minute, because I want to just alert people that everything that Julie has said, that you can capitalize on that in more detail, can chronicle the journey that Julie went through with her daughter in the book that she wrote. Julie, can you just mention a little bit about your book before we do?
Sure. So after my daughter had two surgeries for an appendectomy, which is actually what ended up really changing her health and direction of her condition being finally managed. So she had an appendectomy. It's a alternative to a colostomy bag. So her bowels didn't function. She finally had a manometry, colonic manometry, which tests the bowel's ability to contract and analyzes how the nerves and muscles work together, which hers did not work. So for years, where she struggled with impaction, her bowels didn't actually do their job. So the whole gastro system is kind of a muscular system, with being able to chew, swallow, and then have food move down by the esophagus into the stomach, which also contracts and moves, and then the bowels have to move and contract, and hers just didn't. So she could process food, and it would just sit in her intestines and rot. And so once she had the surgery, which involves taking the appendix, clipping the tip off, and creating a stoma in the back of the belly button, and then an open line, and then she hangs a gravity bag or like an IV bag with bisacodyl, which is a bowel stimulant, Miralax in warm water, and flushes it through, so it's sort of like a reverse enema. She can still go to the bathroom normally, but it is this is what's necessary to make her bowels do their job. So it's kind of like turning on a little hose into the opposite end of the bowel, the top of the bowel, and forcing the waste through. And so this allowed her to have a process of emptying daily without having equipment, or without having to wear anything on a daily basis. So she connects, does her business in the bathroom. It takes about an hour, and then disconnects. And I can't tell you how much difference a child or person feels with bowels that work. So you have to be able to process. Your body has to be able to move air, blood, and food for a normal quality of life, or at least a decent quality of life, which she hadn't had. So I had a child that went from, you know, rolling around on the floor for half of the month, just miserable, unable to eat by probably the third day, her whole entire childhood, and to having a child that, you know, had a very in my view, a pretty simple surgery and a pretty easy process in comparison to what we had grown used to, which was comparable. Her daily process before was comparable to what somebody does for a colonoscopy prep. So horrendous for to try to get a 4-year-old to do that, and then a 9-year-old, and then a 13-year-old. So her life wasn't changed until she had the surgery. And then after she had the surgery, our child was so remarkably different and so had such a better quality of life. We weren't out of the woods totally because she was had lots of malnutrition and growth to catch up with, which we still contend with today. But I was so determined to not really even after until after the fact and until she was better that I became determined to not have others have such a long road. This was such a simple thing to get in front of the right doctors once we did that it could be dealt with effectively. I just felt like her years of feeling miserable were inexcusable, especially since we had spent the time and money, a tremendous amount of that, in the right direction. So we were not in front of the right doctors for years. We were in front of doctors who could, I strongly feel, could have connected more, at least with others, to pull from reserves to help her sooner. So I became real determined just to record our own events. I wanted to not forget some of the things that people said and the order of events and how things kind of went down at the end. So I started writing a few details down, things I didn't want to forget, and I ended up writing pretty much staying in my pajamas for 6 months straight, writing and writing and writing and writing about over a decade of events that led us to this point with a much healthier child. And didn't intend to write a book or anything. I just sat down to write some thoughts and record kind of a journal and then began organizing it. And super impressed with myself that I could do that. And then I read over it and it was a mess. So spent 3 more years editing until now. So I finally have what I hope is a finished product and want to get it out. And I'm working at getting that in front of some people that might be able to do something with it. So somewhat loosely with the hospital and some contacts that they have to maybe assist in not only raising awareness for the condition that she has, but in connecting with others that have any kind of medical trek that is leaves them isolated, or that I feel that any condition that is misunderstood or missed completely, no matter what the condition is, what the symptoms are, a patient can end up just absolutely scrambling in the medical world. And also not really connecting with others. If you don't have a condition that's readily understood by others, it leaves you isolated among even friends and family, where, you know, you might be able to say, talk about diabetes or asthma or something that is common and known. If you have a rare condition, it leaves you pretty isolated. And so that led us to Mary Angela. And so we hope that, I do hope that the book does its job in connecting with others. But in that journey, I've also taken the time to talk to my daughter's doctor about how something like this could end up, and then read some books also written by doctors that their own slants and their own explanations for how patients can be missed when they do things like delicate heart surgeries and handle extreme emergency situations where people come in not even breathing, and how something like my daughter could be missed, of how patients could go and spend the time and money to sit in front of doctors who don't seem to go anywhere, get anywhere with them. And it just seems to settle on, I just keep going back to one word, really, and that's compassion. If doctors don't understand there's a big hesitancy to say, I don't know, which I think we as patients, I know I would have appreciated it. I don't know. I just would have heard that. But I can put you in front of somebody that does, or that I can maybe talk to another doctor that can help. So it's my strong belief that doctors have way more reserves than we do, way more contacts than we do, and that if they don't know, that's fine. But they have friends, and they have colleagues, and they have mentors, and they have contacts that they can connect with. To get them to do that, they have to act not only in a professional way, but a compassionate way. So approach a person and acknowledge their symptoms and their plight as life-altering enough to act, even if they don't know what to do. So anyway, that's my
Anybody want to comment on what Julie has said? Because I know not only parents, but the patients. It's a theme that I hear constantly, and either the doctor doesn't know what to do with them, so after a while, you know, they're very excited, okay, I'm going to take this patient, and then they don't know what to do, and so next thing you know, the behavior starts to change, and the patient is left, I don't know what to do, because the doctor doesn't know what to do, so then they go and find another doctor. It's so demoralizing. And some doctors really, and I know insurance dictates how much time they can spend with patients. There are some outstanding doctors out there who really have dedicated their life, are compassionate, take the time. But then there are those, and I think so many of us may have experienced that, where the doctors just can't say, I don't know, but here is another expert. Or they toss you to another specialist just to get you out of their way, in a sense. Mm-hmm. So it's, Julie, you were talking to me about a couple of books that you were reading. And can you just talk a little bit more about what was in those books? You'll be reading more about it on our website. Julie's going to be writing something, as well as in our new e-magazine that will be coming out. But can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I've read a couple of books. I've got even more lined up to read because it sort of led me on a little path of similar stories. But the one I'm in the middle of now is called Attending. It's by Dr. Epstein. I'm in the middle of that. And then I had also read one called In Shock by Radha Adish, who is an emergency medicine physician turned patient, almost died. And had a long, very complicated multi-surgery issue while she was 7 months pregnant, had a liver problem. Long story short, she ended up in the bed, on the other side of the bed, in the bed. And many of the physicians that approached her to treat her and to deal with her, some knew she was a doctor and some didn't even take the time to see what she did for a living. And didn't know she was a physician, and she was absolutely appalled at how she was dealt with, how she was talked to, and what things were missed. And it wasn't until some others slowed down and took the time and invested the time to help her, she almost died several times, that they actually, her book's called In Shock. Wasn't until some slowed down and actually took a real vested interest in helping her and pulled in multiple people to approach her and help her that they really figured out what she had. It took about a year to really define what she had and fix her, and she's back in practice today, but wrote about it. The other, and her story's real humbling, and it changed the way that she approached patients. And so she's not only written the book, but she now speaks and lectures to graduating students in medical school about that very thing, slowing down and taking the time with patients to treat them as people instead of a case. You know, walking in and with teams of doctors can be intimidating to a patient that's ill, not at their best, maybe alone in a bed and very limited as far as communicating or even keeping up with doctors' conversations, and she talks about how intimidating that is, even for her as a physician. So super humbling, and it changed the way she practiced medicine, changed the way she approached people. The other books, there's about four by Dr. Atul Gawande, and the one I had just recently finished is called Checklist Manifesto. And he talks about different checklists that are required in other in places of employment. For instance, flying a plane, a pilot has a detailed checklist, and these things were put into the industry after human error. And so he talks about ineptitude versus ability. People that make really grave mistakes in the air are skilled, many times very skilled pilots. And he talks about the measure of, you know, something functionally going wrong in a big piece of equipment or just human error oversight. And he likens that to practicing medicine, specifically with patients that are difficult to diagnose, or that might be difficult to communicate with. When someone comes in and has a real cut and dry case and they know exactly what to do, that's not really what he's talking about. Those things are kind of open and shut and obvious and easy. When a doctor doesn't know what to do, he has to pull from his reserves. So they learn the most, he emphasized how doctors learn the most from, not from their years in school or book work, but it's cases and how cases build upon cases. So if a doctor ends up with a case that he's never seen before, he might have a colleague with a case that had a patient with symptoms that were similar that he found out what to do for. And so he talks about how there's no substitute for experience in this area, especially when they can build with the repertoire of other physicians. And so he talked about this not really being a failure, but sort of an ingrained in their training process because they're taught to move quickly and to handle large volumes of patients, stressful cases, people at their absolute breaking point with families, not only with the patient itself, but dealing with families and the pressure to the immense pressure to get things right. But how infrequent it is to actually have a doctor that admits an error, because of liability factors and all sorts of things. They're just trained to not even admit a mistake almost. But he talks about what a high measure of human error there is, just even in timing, in dealing with someone. So in emergency situations, how there's entire teams and a multi-function approach to a patient that is essential to sustain life in emergency situations, that's not how patients are approached in a clinic or an office visit setting. You sit in front of one doctor who may not be communicating with anybody else, and how that really robs a patient of a thorough opinion if they can't be figured out, or if they have symptoms that persist over a longer time frame than the doctor thinks they should, then you could even be deemed as someone who is faking it or is exaggerating. And that can be, as Mary Angela said, that can be deeply discouraging on top of dealing with whatever a patient's dealing with. So our expectations are high and sometimes our returns are low. And he talks about getting in front of the right doctors. How do you do that? So I don't have the answer for that. I don't know.
We were all waiting for that answer.
I don't know. But I do know that communication can be improved upon in both directions. So he does touch a little bit in this book, and I'm interested to see how he describes other patients. He talks about patients that are difficult to communicate with, patients that come in defensive, that don't want to be there, that aren't clear, that don't describe their symptoms in a way that they can relate to or understand, and they're thinking clinically and medically and scientifically and trying to help. That's their job. They most of them take it very seriously. He talks about not connecting with patients, and that sometimes the doctor, if they don't feel a connection with the patient, or if they feel a little bit of defensiveness or resistance, how that closes the doctor off to help. So the patient can largely guide and control how a conversation goes by being more accommodating themselves, or being the patient has to come in and meet the doctor halfway is kind of his point. So it's not all 100%, resting on the doctor. It is up to patients to communicate effectively. And, of course, some of these situations might be high emotion, but that's super hard for a doctor to think clearly in. So when they have only a certain amount of time, and a visit doesn't go how he planned and maybe not go how the patient planned, they both end up falling short. And sometimes that has to be balanced with a physician's overconfidence. Sometimes they jump to conclusions simply because they're frustrated or because the patient's deemed uncompliant. And so then you got a doctor who might be digging his heels in with what he thinks, and it might be really difficult to move forward with a physician like that then decides in his own head, I'm not going to help this person. They're not cooperating. I can't communicate with them, and I don't understand them. It really bars that doctor from doing his job. And so we wouldn't want to do that. But I do think that some relationships with doctors, even if they were initially confused or those that ended up confused, I do think that that can be improved upon by simply acknowledging that factor. You must be frustrated with me. You probably haven't seen people like me before that this went on for this long. So sometimes even just acknowledging that, or acknowledging whatever you suspect that barrier might be, acknowledging it, saying it, and the even if it's uncomfortable, it might disarm the doctor and might open up better communication. Even after reading these books myself, I think I could have done better for years. I could have and should have done better in communicating myself. So...
But Julie, this is Mary Angela. You think that there are a lot of people who go about their lives and then all of a sudden they're vacuumed into this world of medicine that they're unfamiliar with, and they go into survival mode, so they don't know. I mean, I was guilty of that. I didn't know what to do. When I started my journey, I was a very submissive patient. As I started to go through the process of everything, I found my voice. Yeah. And the only problem that I have is because a lot of things I'm not willing to try, a lot of tests I may not do. I've been dealing with this for 40 years now, I think. The doctors then begin to blame the patient or disbelieve the patient that you have all these symptoms, you couldn't possibly be that sick. And that becomes a problem. I just want to add, too, that... there are two things. One is there's a motility doctor, and he spoke at our very first symposium that we had, and he was just such a compassionate man, still is. He used to take some of the tests, the manometry tests, some of the other tests, so that he could understand what the patients would experience. Now, that's an extraordinary doctor.
Mm-hmm.
At another symposium, I was giving a presentation about my illness and trying to be the voice of all the patients, explaining what they go through on a daily basis. And the journey of being misdiagnosed, being dismissed, it's all in your head, all of that. This pediatrician came up to me afterwards and said, I want to thank you very much because because of what I heard you say, I'm going to change the way I practice my medicine. And that was huge. I don't know. I mean, he seemed like such a nice man. But the fact that some of the things that I brought up are what Julie brought up, navigating through the medical system, that emotional part that goes with it, you can't just treat symptoms. It's that whole person. And when you have something that people don't know about, or they're not as familiar with, maybe they've heard about it, maybe they've heard the wrong information with doctors. It can be very challenging. And I know a lot of parents and patients, they now utilize the internet for a lot of their research and for obtaining that information to confront the doctor. You have any comments on that, Julie?
Other than maybe changing up the way they search. So in my situation, having some keywords that, a doctor first diagnoses by suspicion. So they have to have a curious compassion to suspect something. So even if something's suspected and not confirmed, that's worth writing down, taking notes at an appointment, and investigating that way. And if this doctor just suspects something, which is kind of how my daughter's order of things with her went, is a doctor who didn't treat her condition. She was in front of a rheumatologist who suspected certain things and then pointed us to a gastro colleague. So, which ultimately changed the course of things. So even if you're in front of the wrong specialist, he still may mention things that could put you in front of a different doctor or change the way you search for a doctor. And so my thinking is that you got to go somewhere big for the most part, where a teaching facility is that's near you or nearby big city, where there's universities or training programs are a lot of times a really good place to start instead of end up. So your little doctor on Central Boulevard may not be the right fit, but somebody at a large facility that is on a day-to-day basis in contact with many colleagues or has access to those at his fingertips through an email system or even a helpline, which many of those large facilities have. And that would be only at a large facility. So I think that in my case, in my daughter's case, going to those large facilities and starting at the very top, look at the chief of gastro or the chief of, you know, cancer, oncology, whatever it is that you're researching, going to the very top. Even if you can't get in front of that doctor, start with whoever their coordinator is, and then you can go from there to see who is available and who may have openings. But they've possibly been trained under someone that is got decades of experience. So, and I can't say if that would be an older doctor that you're better with or a younger doctor that, new eyes, maybe up really up on new things versus what an old doctor may just kind of stay stuck. I don't know which one is better, but you have to get in front of somebody that has those resources, no matter where they're at in their careers. Doctors at large facilities have those resources more than somebody probably local.
And this is Mary Angela. I just want to add that so many parents as well as patients get in touch and they say, what should I do? They've been to a doctor. In some cases, there's a long waiting list to get there. So finally they get it. And then they're barely seeing the doctor. They're seeing the nurse. They're seeing they're seeing all these other people, a fellow, before they finally see the doctor. And then they get perhaps a diagnosis, or they say you have to take all these tests, and they're just not comfortable with it, or maybe they just don't care for the rapport that they have with the doctor. And I always encourage them, if anything doesn't feel right, it's always okay to get another opinion, a second, a third, a fourth, whatever it takes, because you're living with this 24 hours a day.
Yeah, and it might be years on end. And so the that process is really wearing. And again, acknowledging that to a doctor, you know, I remember one time rattling off to my daughter's doctor how much it cost to sit in front of her for 20 minutes. And the facility that we go to has a facility fee and a physician fee, which totals about $800.
Wow.
So after insurance does their knocks, it's still several hundred, but it's still hundreds of dollars out of pocket for us. In other words, to sit in front of her. And she's not paid that for 20 minutes. We know that. But she had no idea. So here she is in a system, working in a system every day, seeing patients all day long, and she's completely unaware of the fees involved. She had no idea. And so I had requested, how the topic came up was that she kept requesting for me to go to the large main center, the main campus, the hospital, where we're charged that facility fee, whereas if I go to a satellite office, which was ended up being closer for me anyway, I preferred that. I told her why. No, I'm not going to go to the main center. I'm not driving down there. It's a half a day trip, and I'm charged an extra $500 as soon as they park. And I have to pay to park. So these small satellite offices, which is another thing that you can ask about, they're often easier to get into, and the fees are less. So if I go to a satellite office, I'm not charged a facility fee. I'm just charged a doctor fee. It's half the price.
That's excellent information.
Yeah,
Julie, I just want to say somebody just sent a message to me, and mm-hmm. they want to know how you manage to coordinate a team of doctors to help treat your child. They're having
so
trouble.
I didn't. They did. They coordinated this. So by the time I got to in front of a neuromuscular gastro doctor, she coordinated it. And that was the difference, is getting in front of a doctor who's willing to do that. I can help you, but I need help. I need help helping you, and I know people. And that's what she did. So two gastro colleagues spoke. Then they ended up, one ended up assuming care or taking over care from the other. And then she involved a surgeon that hadn't even met. And she put us in front of that surgeon. And all those things happened quickly because she was kind of putting us in the back way instead of going, you know, scheduling these consultations and things separately. So not only did she coordinate the care on our behalf, they moved a little quicker because of her internal requests. So emailing her back and forth, then she brings another doctor and she copies them on the email. It's as simple as that. It's absolutely as simple as that. So if that's not being done on your behalf, ask that it be done. If that doctor doesn't know how to help, ask them who they know that might help. Who do they go to? Ask them straight out, who do you go to if you are stumped? Do you have a mentor who's the chief in this department? Who do you involve when you reach a dead end with a patient whose quality of life is compromised? You don't have to be dying. Your quality of life might just be compromised on a daily basis to where you're robbed of hope and peace of mind. So, and asking for those things with a real level head. I remember asking a doctor, do you believe me? Do you believe me? You know, so I don't know, maybe I should have gone in more of an emotional wreck earlier on and I would have got further. I don't know, but I do fault myself in not communicating more effectively when I thought I did. After reading some of these books, I think I should have been more thorough, maybe ask more questions or pushed more. I always think that you should be polite, always. Even if you feel like you're losing your marbles, I think you have to be very polite and pushy and ask for these things with a big smile on your face and say please and thank you to everyone that you interact with. Necessary for you to get what you need and get what you want.
Yeah.
So
I was going to ask you, Julie, to say the the words that you always say, pushy, polite. And there was one more. What was the
pushy
other one?
Pushy but polite. That's my thing.
Yes.
Pushy but polite. So it ultimately, yeah, and persistent. And ultimately got us where we needed to go. So I should back up a bit. I did kind of lose it. And that's how I ended up in front of this other gastro doctor. I had to spend a half a day on the phone and email going back and forth between nurse coordinators, the doctor who was not available, and a new doctor, and then that changed the course of things. So it wasn't all just done on our behalf. I did have to push. I had to do my due diligence on my end and advocate. And that's something I talk about in the book. My book is advocating for yourself. Learn how to advocate for yourself. Learn how to speak up. Learn how to ask for what you want or need, even if you don't know quite what you're asking for. And ask those things. So maybe doing some research on or reading even something which I haven't read on patients that are advocating for themselves or for your child to get in front of specialists that they know can help. So even if it's outside that doctor's medical group, so if the doctor, you know, practices at, you know, one university campus and you've exhausted the resources there, or the doctor, you've reached a dead end, ask who else they know. So often these doctors are in these real specialized areas of medicine, they know each other. So they might have colleagues at a different campus, a different facility, different medical center altogether that they just know of that has a good reputation, or they know of the chief over at another facility that they can at least guide you to. And sometimes with a little bit of professional courtesy, those things can be arranged. So if you can't get in front of a chief of staff of whatever, often at a doctor's request, they'll make an exception to see a patient. So you might be able to end up in front of a top doctor who, just picking up the phone on your own, you wouldn't be able to get in front of. The waiting list is too long, or it's the doctor's not accepting new patients or whatever. If you have the physician's office you're already with call on your behalf, they might get a different answer. So those are some of the things that I learned along the way, the hard way, that doctor to doctor communicating on behalf of a patient is perceived and accepted differently, treated differently sometimes. That's just the nature of business.
Julie, when this last time when your daughter was in the hospital, now she's a teenager, so it was different. The dynamic was different. And how does your daughter advocate now on her own during the medical stays?
She doesn't. So I'm still speaking up. And that's yet ahead. That's yet ahead. So I don't see that ending anytime soon. She just turned 18, and we had to sign all kinds of consents to, you know, allow me into the room. It's horrible. It's horrible. So as horrible as I think it is, they're used to it. They have young ones that turn 18 and become of age all the time, and it's natural for them to, you know, legalize that by keeping the parents still in the loop of things. My daughter's stable and doing okay, but she's nowhere near being able to handle these things on her own. So I'll continue to communicate and advocate for her. But and every time we have a office visit or hospital stay, well, I learn something new. So
interesting.
Humbling. Yeah.
The doctors, do they, when they're talking to her, do they treat her differently because she's a teenager, in your opinion?
Well, I welcomed them talking directly to her. You know, she can communicate effectively, although she's not real thorough. She can answer questions and such, but the doctor has to be kind of saying all the words and her nodding or saying yes or no, because she doesn't want to give details or doesn't want to really speak up. But she's even had to learn to do that on her own. But yeah, having a teenager that doesn't want to be there in the first place is another topic in and of itself. But we're learning as we go. She has to learn how to communicate this on her own. But yeah, as soon as you have a teenager, then you start realizing that this is really a different world. There's all kinds of things where you're excused from the room and hospital stays. They have to question the child, and it's just insane.
God.
So,
so yeah. Different now. It really is so different when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. But it boils down again to that communication.
Yeah.
Your daughter has to learn to do that in order for her to be on her own and handle this when she's more independent.
And she's not outspoken, and she's not real forthright with details, and she's not real pushy naturally. She's much more timid than I am. So, those are things that she's going to have to develop with her own personality and her own confidence level in time as she grows and matures, which is fine. That's what I'm here for in the meantime. But, hopefully she's learned some just from being her mom, that you have to push and you have to advocate for yourself. So hopefully she grasps that. And, maybe even without my presence in the near future, she would do even better or even more. There might be a big barrier with me sitting in the room with her thinking, well, I don't need to speak up and I don't need to advocate for myself. I got Julie here. I got mom here.
Yeah.
So that might be a disservice to her, but she'll have to learn that when she's put in that position in the future.
Yeah. Interesting.
She won't be here.
Interesting. Does anybody else want to jump into the conversation? I know we have a few people here, but they're being very quiet. I guess, Julie, it must be because you're so interesting, your story, and they're just taking copious notes because they're learning so much. But I will tell all of you, this program, as you know, is being recorded. Or if you don't know and you came in like midpoint, it is being recorded and it will appear on our new website as soon as the editing is done and it is ready for processing. So you can be on the lookout. Our new website is www.agmdhope.org. Thought I'd just interject that. Julie, we only have a couple minutes left. Is there anything that you wanted to add or talk about and tell us?
Other than I'll write a couple of paragraphs about those couple of books that I've read and summarize them. And I'll have I can put the name of the book and the author. A lot of these doctors have websites as well that talk about kind of their mission or their intent on writing. And so even some of them have video clips like that. Dr. Oddish has a couple YouTube clips. You can kind of gather what her book's about and her mode of writing and her slant of things by looking at a couple of her speaking engagements. And she's very good. That Atul Gawande is even better. He's just has got such a viewpoint on, he's a surgeon and he's actually in the Boston area, but just very, very, very articulate, very good with his description of the way the medical world works. And so they're worth looking at. Those are books, a couple of them I only listened to. So some of them are available through your library. And I can indicate that if you have a library card, you can check some of these books out even on audio form for free or get on a waiting list. If you even have multiple library cards in different counties, it pulls in more. But some of these are available for free without having to spend the money to read or listen to them. And can
as
probably
you can
do
see,
so inside of a week.
As you can see, Julie is an avid reader. You'll be hearing more about her book as well as some of the other books that
hopefully
she has read or listened to. Oh, I think you will.
But
I think that book, it's been on pause, just waiting for that right moment when it's ready for the launch. Do you have a title for that book when it does come out?
You know, I'm leaning more and more towards pushy but polite.
So love it.
I think I'll call it that. I don't know. It's not set, but that's the one I keep going back to because it seems to that little thing kind of seems to reappear in the book, not only that I say it, but I reference doctors and nurses, what I perceive as them being pushy but polite. Doctors that had to be pushy on our behalf, or nurses that had to be pushy on our behalf. And so, and then maybe a little subtitle under it of, you know, of the mother's journey through the medical systems in Southern California, or something to that effect that would describe what the book's about. But so one thing to write, and it's another thing to get a cover on it. Super humbling, awful process, but one I hope to see through.
I can attest to that. When Julie said, no, I wrote a book, and I'm going, okay then. Geez, this is wonderful. And I've kind of been on this journey in some way with Julie as she was writing this. And
so sorry.
God, it was like a labyrinth. That's all I can say. It was a nightmare to see how you think you finally have it done, and then it's going to be cut some more. What is the maximum amount of words?
Well, I mean, it's not a set thing, but there are definitely guides that are would indicate what a reasonable size book would be, whether it's, you can't really err on having something too small, which is probably more tempting to people these days because everyone's so busy, but definitely something too big. So when I first finished writing, in about 6 months, I wrote about 170,000 words and 300 pages, single spaced and word, much too big. Compare it would be about the size of Little Women or Tale of Two Cities. My book is not worthy of that size. The subject, the genre that I'm writing in is not, people wouldn't buy it. That would be a complete turnoff. So I had to then go back and edit. And the only way I can really describe what that's like is it would be like cutting up family pictures. That's what it felt like. It felt like cutting up pictures that you couldn't get back. And so even though I have it saved in 100 places and different versions of it, I couldn't actually retrieve stuff, but it was extremely difficult, and that I'm not a professional writer of any kind. So didn't know what I was doing, learned along the way, and again, learned the hard way. I guess that's just how I approach life. And I now have a book that's just a little over 100,000 words, which is much more reasonable to present to an agent in turn of publishing house, because your book can be rejected simply because it's too long. It shows you don't know how to hone your point. You don't know how to tell the story in a concise and tempting way because you talk too much. Anyway, write too much, whatever. But anyway, I've had to learn to say what I need to say in less words. So blocks of the book, all of the book's been reanalyzed and rewritten about 5 times, but taking a story or a scene that's 1,500 words and trying to reword it and tell it in 500 words. So cutting things by a third in most of the sections has been unbelievably arduous, very, very tedious work. So hopefully something can become good of it, you know.
You'll be hearing more about the book as it goes through this ultimate journey of being published. You'll hear more about that, of course, in a magazine and a website as it comes. Julie, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for all the incredible information you have given us and for taking the time to do this. I know we had a quiet group today, but I hope that all of you who are listening got something out of this. And if you need to communicate or you have some questions, please just reach out. I can certainly give the information to Julie, and I'm sure she would be willing to assist. You are all, even though I know you're all parents, we have a few patients here, I end these programs the same way each time, that you are all my heroes. Because I know after you leave that doctor's office, you're living with this 24 hours a day. And that all of you inspire this organization to offer programs like this. And to the little doggy that's barking in the background.
Sorry, it's mine. It's
oh, it's yours.
I thought it was. As usual.
Well, welcome to the conversation and goodbye
yes.
to you too.
All right. Goodbye. Thank you.
Goodbye, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
God bless.
God bless.
Bye-bye.